From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. The best way to support the show is by booking a Disneyland, Walt Disney World, Disney Cruise Line, or Adventures by Disney vacation with Dreams Unlimited Travel. Get a free no-obligation quote today for your next dream vacation at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hey there, hi there, ho there, and welcome to episode 286 of Connecting with Walt. I am your host and Diz historian, Michael Bowling, and I am joined by my co-host, executive producer, and good friend, Craig Williams. Craig, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you, Michael?
I am doing well. So are you getting ready to make your corned beef and cabbage this weekend and getting your DVD of Darby O'Gill to watch for St. Patrick's Day?
Maybe I am. So I definitely am going to be getting to the grocery store to get my corned beef. I need to pick that up. But even more importantly, I need to get over to one of the liquor stores in the area and get some Guinness because I have not.
You better hurry on that.
Everyone keeps telling me that it's selling out quickly everywhere. I'm like, usually I buy it like the day before and I'm fine. But everyone keeps like warning me. So I've got to make it a priority today and try not to drink it all before the holiday rolls around.
See, I boil my corned beef and cabbage in beer, so that's why I have to get it early.
Yeah, so, I did that last year, I think, and I really like that result, but I don't know. I might go lazy this time and just do the crock pot, maybe still throw in a little bit and see if it has the same effect, but I need it too for my beef stew that I do. So regardless,
I've never done it with beef stew. Huh.
Oh, yeah. I did. I started making that about like 5 years ago, 4 years ago. I think it was during the pandemic when I was bored and just like, okay, what ingredients do I have? And what beer do I have? And yeah, I started doing a Guinness beef stew. And it just adds a little bit of extra richness to it, a little extra texture. You get some of the kind of chocolate cocoa notes in it, but not in an extreme way. Just like it's a nice little balance to the saltiness of a beef stew. So I really enjoy it.
That sounds good. Yeah, I'll try that. The beef stew recipe I make now is a really old recipe from the Liberty Tree Tavern at the Magic Kingdom. It was a beef stew recipe. I think they must have served it when they first opened. And it is excellent. I've served it for, you know, when I've had guests over. And it's that good.
Wow.
And I add to it. I add more veggies and stuff and more herbs and things. Yeah. But, but like my corned beef and cabbage, I put in parsnips, turnips, you know, more root vegetables and things.
Yeah. I do the same thing. The recipes never have enough like root vegetables, and especially when it's like, oh, put one sprig of thyme and then bay leaf.
Oh, I know.
Just like, that. Only that. No, got to take it up a little bit more, make it a little more flavorful. But I would rather overdo it than underdo it.
Yeah. And that's sort of like what this recipe is. It is like that. Put in some thyme, oregano, and a bay leaf. Now I have to put in a little more than that.
Yeah, so. Just that's too boring. Yeah, it's not. Yeah. The Irish would be upset with us if that's what we left it as.
So anyway, and how are we doing on our QA show? I have not looked even to see.
Yeah, we
how our
still
are doing.
We still have questions trickling in. I just got a couple new ones in here, but we are going to be getting closer and closer to recording. So you are running out of time to ask your questions. And again, the best way to ask the questions is by going to facebook.com/DizUnlimited. And on that page, our Diz Unlimited page, there's a pinned post that has right where you're going to ask your question at, and just drop it in the comments. Of course, you know, don't ask us what we think Walt Disney would think of this or that. And also try to make it a question that's just not answered easily by a yes or a no. I know you all know how to do this. But for some reason, if you're not on Facebook and you still want to get a question to us, the best ways would be through our Twitter account. That's at Connecting Walt. Not Connecting with Walt, just at Connecting Walt. And you can always, you know, just make sure that we're tagged in it, so that way we can get notified of your question. And then really, if you're not on social media at all, then I guess the next best way is by either emailing Michael or myself. And we give our emails at the end of the episode, but we might as well do it right now, just so that way people can definitely get to us if they need to. Mine is craig@disneyinfo.com. And Michael, yours is?
Michael. No, what is it? I don't even look it up anymore.
It's Michael Bowling@disneyinfo.com.
Right. Couldn't remember if it was Michael or Michael Bowling, because it changed. Michael Bowling@disneyinfo.com.
Yeah, and you're lucky because you don't have a dot or anything in it as well. Mm-hmm. Like, I believe Rhino's is rhino.clavin@disneyinfo.com. It's like, how many rhinos do we have working here that we have to start adding dots to it? But yeah, so if you really aren't on social media at all, you can't find someone else to ask your question, just, you know, send us an email and we'll make sure that it gets added to the entire list. And maybe we'll be answering your question very soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, looking forward to it. All right. Well, in our previous episode, we began our exploration of the history of Walt Disney's Fantasia. We started with Walt's creation of The Sorcerer's Apprentice, starting out as a silly symphony cartoon short. And then we talked about its transition to a concert film and the research that took place. We also talked about the development of the first two selections of the film, Toccata in Fugue in D minor and the Nutcracker Suite. We'll continue today with a revisiting of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. We went into quite a bit of detail about it in our previous episode. The Sorcerer's Apprentice is a scherzo for orchestra by Paul Dukas, and it was first performed in Paris in 1897. And similar to Fantasia, it's a translation of one medium into another. So it's a humorous retelling in music of Goethe's ballad, The Apprentice Musician, about a magician's lazy apprentice who, whilst his master is away, uses the incantations he has learned to bring a broom to life and make it carry water for him. Now, by 1937, Americans identified with Mickey Mouse, and the world identified Mickey Mouse with America. Mickey Mouse and his alter ego, Walt Disney, embodied America's spirit of adventure, curiosity, innovation, and optimism. So in May 1937, Walt Disney's agents contacted the American agent for Dukas's publisher to purchase the rights to use the music in an animated cartoon. As we talked about in our previous episode, a chance meeting at a restaurant between Walt and Leopold Stokowski led to the conductor being a part of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. So less than 2 months before the premiere of Snow White, Walt wrote his representative saying, "I am all steamed up over the idea of Stokowski working with us on The Sorcerer's Apprentice. I feel that the possibilities of such a combination are so great that we could stretch a point and use his 100 men, as well as work out an arrangement to compensate him personally for his time. And we could well afford to record the music in any manner Stokowski would want to do. In fact, I think so much of the idea that I have already gone ahead and now have the story in work with this crew on the chance that we will be able to get together with Stokowski and possibly have the music recorded within a short time." And the reason that Walt mentioned to work out an arrangement to compensate him, Stokowski volunteered his time and efforts originally with The Sorcerer's Apprentice as it transitioned into being a full concert feature. Then Walt did work out a compensation arrangement with Stokowski. So Walt cast Mickey Mouse as the Sorcerer's Apprentice, combining the force of the Mickey Mouse cartoon shorts with the Silly Symphony cartoon shorts. So this was the best possible action with the best possible music. Walt assigned Perse Pierce as the animation director, with Carl Fahlberg on story and Lee Harline as musical director. But later, Walt reassigned Pierce and Fahlberg to Bambi and brought on James Algar as the director. And Algar had animated the animals on Snow White. To supervise the animation, Walt brought on the same team who had supervised the animation of the Seven Dwarfs, Fred Moore and Bill Tytla. Moore was the studio's Mickey expert at this time and would redesign Mickey to give him a greater range of emotion. And this would be the first time Mickey Mouse would have pupils in his eyes.
Yeah, a big, big change for Mickey Mouse there. And I mean, I would arguably say that it transitions into maybe my favorite era and look for Mickey Mouse. Like, Michael, I know your favorite era is the one that we're currently in with Runaway Railway and and you know the shorts. But I think this Fantasia look might be my favorite one.
It is for me as well. And you know, that's where we see the rounder Mickey and his there's more fluidity to his motion in here as well. So this went on to really be the icon of the Walt Disney Studio.
Yep.
This version of Mickey.
And we nonstop buy merchandise with it.
Yep, absolutely. By November 9th, the first two sections of rough continuity were completed. On November 15th, Pierce provided the Disney staff with a synopsis of Goethe's ballad. Now, Walt always retold stories to himself and his staff to see how clearly, simply, and briefly he could state the theme. He now told the story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice in three sentences. He said, "The thought is this. Mickey is an apprentice that wanted the power of the sorcerer to do his work. Then, when that happens and he has that power, then he dreams of his great power. But when he awakens and finds what the broom has done and he hasn't the power to stop the broom, we find Mickey having to resort to an axe to try to stop the broom's work." So very, very concise there.
Yeah, but kind of nails it all. That better description than I can give of it. Yeah. I'd make it more complicated.
Today we would call it the elevator speech.
Yeah, elevator pitch. Yep.
Yeah. So the Sorcerer's Apprentice would be the one sequence in Fantasia that most closely matched the intentions of its composer. Now, Walt was very interested in Mickey's dreams of power and thought of, quote, "Mickey up there on that rock, directing those planets and those comets and pulling up the ocean. Have a lot of upshots, looking up at the guy, you know, like you'd shoot up at an orchestra conductor as he is conducting. Naturally, Stokowski doesn't burlesque, but we're a caricature," unquote. As Walt was working on Mickey's dreams of power, Stokowski was thinking about the personality of the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and a letter from him arrived on November 30th that read, "May I make a suggestion which perhaps is entirely impractical or does not fit into your other ideas? What would you think of creating an entirely new personality for this film instead of Mickey? A personality that could represent you and me. In other words, someone that would represent in the mind and heart of everyone seeing the film their own personality, so that they would enter into all the drama and emotional changes of the film in a most intense manner. It seems to me that one of the most potent factors in the worldwide popularity of films is that the onlooker enters personally into the story, puts himself or herself in the place of the hero or heroine, and by doing so, feels every moment of the drama. That is why I feel that if you create a new personality, which represents every one of us, it might be a valuable factor in the years to come and enlarge the scope. This is merely a suggestion, which discard immediately if it does not interest you. Well, this idea definitely did not interest Walt, and he did not acknowledge it in his reply to the conductor. Walt wanted Mickey to be the hero. There were more than a few similarities between Walt's and Mickey's careers. Mickey had gone from conducting just a few musicians in the band concert to a dreamer on a mountaintop conducting the universe. Walt had started out just a few years ago with a small studio, in charge of a few associates, to a state-of-the-art studio with close to 1,000 associates. And the success of Snow White was just a few months away. It is no coincidence that the name given to the sorcerer in Fantasia is Yen Sid, which is Disney spelled backwards. When the sequence ends, we see Mickey's silhouette climb Stokowski's dais to shake hands with the conductor in a gesture that represents the partnership between Stokowski and Walt Disney in creating this landmark fusion of music and animation. The only spoken dialogue in the film is when Mickey congratulates Mr. Stokowski. So what are your thoughts? Before we move on, Craig, what are your thoughts on The Sorcerer's Apprentice?
I really love Sorcerer's Apprentice. I mean, it is a classic. It is, what else do you say about it? I mean, it has spawned so much joy in the world through that one sequence. I mean, I think even though it might not be my favorite sequence in Fantasia, I think it's the one that, you know, everyone recognizes it, even if they don't know that it's from Fantasia. They know Sorcerer Mickey because he has taken on such a big life in many different ways, whether on merchandise as the logo for years of Walt Disney Imagineering mm-hmm. in Fantasmic. It's Sorcerer Mickey has just exploded beyond what, you know, what this sequence originally was. And, you know, you just can't look past its importance. The same way as with the classic cartoons, you know, Steamboat Willie's not my favorite of the classic Mickey shorts, but at the same time, you can't ignore the importance of how moving it is, how powerful it is, how important to Disney fans it is. And, you know, it's beautiful, beautiful animation throughout the entire short. That music, to me, I can't imagine it without the actual animation with it. It was as if mm-hmm. they designed the animation and actually scored music around it, unlike so many other sequences in Fantasia that, you know, it feels the opposite. So I'm still in awe of it now as much as I was the very first time I watched it. And when I was a kid, this is actually when I usually shut it off. You know, I fast forward through Toccata and Fugue, watch Nutcracker, Sorcerer's Apprentice, and then I turned it off.
Oh, the dinosaurs didn't even intrigue you.
Too long. So not a spoiler alert for that upcoming sequence, but yeah, just a little too long for my taste, even to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved this sequence, you know, when I was a little boy, you know, when I saw it being re-released to theaters. And you know, this one, it, you know, this is so popular, you know, that when they released Fantasia 2000, this was included.
Yeah.
In it. It was a shame they didn't really do a better job remastering it for Fantasia 2000, because I saw it, with the whole family, we all went and we saw it in IMAX, a true IMAX theater. Did not hold up well big giant IMAX screen. But I think it just showed how popular this is and how beloved this particular selection is. And even like we had VHS tapes and all that, where just this sequence was just on the tape along with other Mickey shorts and all that. So
They always found a way to showcase it by itself anytime they could, which I think that's why so many people know it.
Right, exactly. And they haven't done that with the other selections from Fantasia. For Christmas-themed shows, when I was little on The Wonderful World of Color, they'd pull out the Nutcracker sweet segment. Things like that. But
that is true. And there, they had parts of A Night on Bald Mountain as
for part Halloween. Of
the Disney Halloween. So, I guess those parts, but never the extended sequences. Like, because I usually turned it off as a kid, I remember the first time I saw A Night on Bald Mountain as part of Fantasia, watching it the whole way through, and it goes into Ave Maria. And I was like, what? This isn't from a Disney Halloween. It always just ended. So, but with Sorcerer's Apprentice, we so many opportunities to see that from start to finish in so many ways. They always love pushing it out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And for the Nutcracker Suite, they would pull out these winter scenes, but not the autumn scenes or anything like that.
Yeah.
Mentioned the dinosaurs, the next selection we'll talk about is the Rite of Spring selection. And Igor Stravinsky composed the Rite of Spring as a pantomime ballet, and it was performed a year later in Paris. It was choreographed to suggest tribal dances and rituals in prehistoric Russia. However, Stravinsky never considered this to be the only possible interpretation of his work, and he once wrote, "The pretext of the prehistoric birth of spring suggested to me the construction of the work. The rite exists as a piece of music first and last." Now, Walt Disney visualized the Rite of Spring telling the story of the evolution of life on Earth during its first billions of years in existence and is divided into 8 sections. First is the trip through space, and the audience here is to imagine themselves in space looking down on the lifeless planet Earth. Then there's the volcanoes. The volcanoes erupt and hot lava flows, reach the sea, and the Earth begins to cool. Then there's the undersea life and growth, starting with one-celled creatures, and life develops, leading to the first sea creature developing legs and emerging from the sea and walking on land. Then we come to the pterodactyls, the flying reptiles of the Jurassic period dive and glide through the air, and one becomes dinner for another creature. Family life. This is the age of the dinosaurs, in which we see Dimetrodon, Stegosaurus, Brontosaurus, Triceratops, and others raising and feeding their young. Fight is next, and one of the most exciting sequences. This is the survival of the fittest. A Stegosaurus is attacked by a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Volcanoes begin to rumble and erupt, warning of changes in the earth. Then there's the trek, and that terrible heat is drying up the water and plant life as we see dinosaurs migrate in search of water. This sequence depicts the late Cretaceous extinction that took place over 70 million years ago, making the way for mammals and the evolution of humans. Then it's the earthquakes, and the earthquakes open up huge fissures. Volcanoes burst to the surface of the oceans, creating tidal waves. Now, the first time Walt heard the Rite of Spring on November 13, 1938, he exclaimed, "This is marvelous! It would be perfect for prehistoric animals." Until then, Walt and his team had been considering Stravinsky's Firebird for the concert feature. But Walt had then asked, "Was there ever anything written on which we might build something of a prehistoric theme with prehistoric animals?" Dean Taylor suggested the Rite of Spring and played a recording of the ballet. "There would be something terrific in dinosaurs, flying lizards, and prehistoric monsters," said Walt. "There could be beauty in the settings." Joe Grant suggested it could be a dawn of a creation theme. As Walt continued to show enthusiasm about a prehistoric sequence for the Rite of Spring, whose original choreography told the story of the ritual sacrifice of a maiden, Stokowski suggested, Perhaps we could in some way retain the idea of a sacrifice. The jungle is full of sacrifice, animals preying upon each other and being preyed upon. That is life. If we could put that on the screen and end with the most terrific and terrifying of the animals fighting and eating each other, people would gasp. Walt loved this idea, saying, we could base it on the dog-eat-dog idea all the way through. We could have a battle and build it to a grand climax. It is the fight for life. It is important to note that Walt Disney included the Rite of Spring in Fantasia based on a suggestion by Deems Taylor rather than Stokowski. And I mention this because Stravinsky's widow, Vera, and Robert Kraft mistakenly assumed when they wrote in Stravinsky in Pictures and Documents that the rite was undoubtedly Stokowski's, not Disney's choice. This was most likely based on the fact that as early as 1927, Stokowski had written to Stravinsky asking if he could study his score and, with the composer's permission, would like to record it. The choice of all the music in Fantasia was Walt Disney's. At the studio, the final decision on all matters was Walt's. As Dick Humer once said, he was absolute monarch there. Why not? He made it. Rite of Spring was considered to be Stravinsky's most controversial score and created a scandal when it premiered in Paris in 1913. Stokowski explained the ballet's history to Walt, saying the music has never been done justice to because it is so powerful, and then suggested they cut out about 18 or 19 minutes. Walt used 30 minutes of the ballet, but changed the sequence of movements to fit the continuity of the visual story. It was agreed that the theme of the sequence would be dramatic rather than comical. When considering another piece of music for inclusion in Fantasia, Walt asked Stokowski, should we stick as closely as possible to the original ideas behind this music? Stokowski replied, composers are not a bit strict about those things. They write for a certain idea, but when you suggest something else, they are likely to agree. We shouldn't worry if the spirit of the music is with us. The story of the relationship between Walt and Igor Stravinsky is one of a composer who first wasn't, and then was, strict about those things.
Fantastic.
Oh, this is notorious, this relationship between them.
Yeah, I can only imagine how stressful it would be. I mean, I feel like if it was my work, I would be strict about those things, but that's just me. You know, everyone's different and up to different interpretations, but it's a weird position to be in.
Now, the Disney studio had already been in contact with Stravinsky. Back on April 12, 1938, when Fantasia's music was still being selected, Disney's agent reached out to Stravinsky's publisher requesting permission to use the Firebird for the concert feature. When the Firebird was dropped from consideration for the feature and the Rite of Spring selected, the agent requested the rights for this piece. Stravinsky instructed his New York attorney to sign a contract with Walt Disney Productions for, quote, the irrevocable right, license, privilege, and authority to record in any manner, medium, or form Rites of Spring for use in the film Fantasia, unquote. The contract was signed on January 4, 1939, and according to Kraft and Mrs. Stravinsky, $6,000 was paid for the right to use the piece. Just before Christmas 1939, Stravinsky and choreographer George Balanchine visited the studio. They were shown The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which Stravinsky told Walt he liked. They were also shown the storyboards and models for The Rite of Spring, which was being animated. Stravinsky posed for many photos with Walt and his artist, and joked with one of the animators working on his music. Wolfgang Reitherman recalled this, saying, we were having our Christmas party. I was animating the dinosaurs at that time. And after a few drinks, I went into my room and started running the soundtrack to Rite of Spring backwards. You didn't hear the melody, but you sure heard some pretty dynamic sounds. I was enjoying it. Suddenly the door opened, and there was Walt and Igor Stravinsky. Stravinsky was very nice about it. He said, "Sounds good backwards, too." According to Kraft and Mrs. Stravinsky, the composer was shown the finished film of Rite of Spring on October 12, 1940. 11 days later, on October 23rd, two Disney directors called on Stravinsky to discuss the possibility of making an animated film of Renard and wanted to use the composer's score about the fox in the barnyard. On October 28th, he sold an option to Disney to use Renard, Fireworks, and the Firebird. Years later, Stravinsky was quoted as disliking Disney's version of Rite of Spring, saying it was terrible, and claimed that he walked out after viewing only a portion of it. Kraft and Vera Stravinsky explained that the composer signed the contracts because he believed his music would never be used. This is hard to believe, since Stravinsky signed the contracts only a few days before the release of Fantasia, and Walt was so confident of its success, the work had already started on the Peter and the Wolf selection for a second Fantasia. Stravinsky did not care that Fantasia would introduce his music to the masses and might inspire them to seek out more of his works. He did not believe that music could be helped by means of an increase in the quantity of listeners through film or any other medium. Music, he said, could be helped only through an increase in the quality of listening, the quality of the individual soul.
That is such a weird take. I think it is fascinating how sometimes the best artists that we know were ones that had no true success during the time that they were actually alive. You know, Van Gogh is a very big example of that, being so revered and beloved after his death, but completely shunned by the world during his life. I feel like it's one of those things where, I mean, it's that takes a lot of gumption to be like, yeah, I don't care if more people hear it. I'm okay with that. It's mm-hmm. It's more about the music than anything else. Good for you, buddy. I want to make money.
It's all about the art. Yes.
Yeah, is it?
From the beginning, Walt and his team saw The Rite of Spring as a scientific document. According to John Hubley, who was art director for 3 of the 8 sections, Walt explained what he wanted in 15 simple words. Quote, "As though the studio had sent an expedition back to the Earth 6 billion years ago," unquote. Now, this was before the space age, so the studio's special effects department would be some of its most imaginative work. It would not be possible to animate 1,000 stars for the trip through space scene, so a model of the Earth was made using a 30-watt Mazda light globe, about 18 inches in diameter and painted red. It was illuminated and rotated to show the craters. The Earth globe was suspended at the end of a dark room about 20 feet long. Then the effects animators created the stars by hanging beads of different sizes on the ends of threads of different lengths. At the end of the room, behind the Earth, was a dark screen. This screen had hundreds of pinholes that were illuminated from behind. When the 35mm camera moved through the bead stars towards the light globe Earth, the pinholes of light provided the illusion of the universe of stars twinkling beyond the Earth. And this was how they created Walt's vision of endless space. Ken, just their innovation in this era just amazes me.
Yeah, it's stuff that I don't even know how they thought about it. It shows how not creative I am when it comes to this stuff. But I mean, I can also look at it and be like, well, you know what? They did a lot of the innovating. What really is there still left to innovate in the world of film and photography and media? And I'm sure there is still a lot left, but now they're absolute pioneers just doing breathtaking work.
Yeah. And without computer graphics.
Yeah, which I don't know. Sometimes I hate my computer and I'm like, it doesn't do the things I want it to do. Are they as good as they need to be?
Since many of the visuals in Rite of Spring had to reproduce things never seen by humans, the team made careful studies of archaeology and prehistory. For example, how would they create the primeval convulsions of the Earth's surface? Josh Meter, who was the supervisor of special effects, mixed a gummy mixture of oatmeal, mud, and coffee in a vat. He then sent bubbles up through it with air hoses. High-speed cameras photographed the movement. The individual frames were processed on cells dyed red against a yellow background. Then animation was added to create more splashes and action. This was all photographed against backgrounds with controlled light intensities to create the convincing visuals of mud pops bubbling, breaking, and splashing. Again, just amazing to me.
Yeah, incredible.
Another problem facing the animators was visualizing the scale of the dinosaurs. Bill Roberts, who was the co-director of Rite of Spring with Paul Satterfield, suggested, just draw a 12-story building in perspective, then convert it into a dinosaur and animate it. Sounds simple.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I never really thought about it like that, but not a bad idea to really get your scale going.
Roberts decided the most effective way to show the immensity of a creature that was 47 feet long and 18 feet high would be to have the audience view it from below. So the camera level was kept very low. During a story meeting, it was suggested using a triceratops in the battle. But another story man said, no, we want to use the stegosaurus because of his action of his tail with the four spikes. And so it became a battle of the Stegosaurus and Tyrannosaurus Rex, and would be, as Stokowski wanted, the most terrific and terrifying of animals fighting and eating each other, and people would gasp. When Wooly Reitherman was animating the dinosaurs, Walt advised him, don't make them cute animal personalities. They've got small brains, you know. Make them real. Paleontologists Barnum Brown of Manhattan's American Museum of Natural History and Chester Stock of California Institute of Technology were hired as consultants, and pet iguanas and a baby alligator were brought to the studio for the animators' inspiration. Of course, no human had ever seen the movement of a stegosaurus tail. Scientists had been able to reconstruct the skeletons of dinosaurs, so it's giving us an accurate idea of their size, shape, and weight. Thanks to the Disney artists and animators' knowledge of balance and weight, combined with their study of skeletal remains, they were able to create an educated visualization of how these creatures may have moved.
And I do feel like, you know, I got to give a little bit of tribute to one of my favorite movies of all time, King Kong, because you have the sequence in that on Skull Island with dinosaurs and Kong fighting the T-Rex there. And I feel like, you know, that's done stop motion animation style. So it's a lot more jittery, not fluid, but I feel like, you know, that got a lot of it right too. And that was kind of the walking. And then Disney took over and sprinted with it years mm-hmm. later. And yeah, it's another one of those examples of do we only know it now because Disney was the one kind of showing it off, and that's completely warped our entire perspective on it. But I mean, clearly that's a good thing, since there's plenty of scientists saying, yeah, this is what was. So now, you know, yeah. So it's just incredible.
I remember reading years ago that like this was the first film that showed that the dinosaurs did not drag their tails, that they used their tails as balance. So they had them lifted up. And all other films and renditions of them, drawings always showed their tails on the ground. And now, of course, it's accepted that they use their tails as sort of a fulcrum to balance.
Yeah. I'm going to have to go back to older stuff and see that, because I'm trying to picture it, and there's a couple things where I absolutely know what you're talking about. I've seen it dragging that way, so I'm just amazed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's very impressive. In fact, the Disney animators were so successful that after Fantasia was released, nationally known scientists agreed that prehistoric life had become an exciting reality. The New York Academy of Science asked for a private showing of Ride of Spring because they believed its dinosaurs, quote, was better science than whole museum loads of fossils and taxidermy, unquote. Originally, Walt had intended to carry the sequence story beyond the death of the dinosaurs to the Age of Mammals and the First Men to Fire and the Triumph of Man. But according to John Hubley, fundamentalists threatened to make trouble for the studio if Walt connected evolution with human beings. Walt, concerned that Fantasia may already have some challenges being accepted by the general public, which we will learn later it did, decided not to tempt a creationist boycott. Remember, it had only been 15 years since the famous Scopes trial, in which a high school teacher was put on trial for teaching evolution in a public school. One of the greatest testimonies to the educational value of the Rite of Spring selection is by one of the leading paleontologists, Stephen Jay Gould, whose dedication in his book, Ever Since Darwin, Reflections in Natural History, reads, "For my father, who took me to see the Tyrannosaurus when I was 5. So that's sweet, I think. What a nice dedication.
That is.
So Craig, so as a little boy, that this sequence didn't interest you.
No, it didn't. And I mean, it is still probably my least favorite sequence in Fantasia. I don't know. I mean, obviously, like, Toccata and Fugue isn't the best right at the beginning, but Rite of Spring just goes on too long for me. It's not that I don't like the music, and obviously the animation special effects are just something else. I mean, it's truly, truly breathtaking visuals in there, but I don't know. I still get bored with it to this day. I have trouble holding my interest, and I don't know if it's because I'm just not connecting as much with the actual music in it. I don't know if it's that we've come such a long way with dinosaurs, and you know, Fantasia was the end all be all of dinosaurs clearly back in that day based on scientists. But then I feel like the first Jurassic Park movie then is like our modern day take on that too, of bringing dinosaurs to life in the next most realistic way. I'm not sure if it's that. I don't really know what it is that doesn't grip me. I think it kind of is the music and the overall length. If they could have trimmed it down, you know, that 18-19 minutes that was mentioned, I think I'd be in a complete different space with it. But the dinosaurs, you know, it goes extinct in my book. If I had to chop one sequence out, it would be this one.
See, as a boy, I loved this. I had so many dinosaur books. Now, as a boy, I was just fascinated with dinosaurs, and I read everything I could on them. We didn't have much in the Academy of Sciences in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. They didn't have a whole lot on dinosaurs. But so I love this. And even when I was little, I was impressed. I remember being intrigued by how the movement of the creatures and the dinosaurs was timed so well to the beats of the music. Maybe it's because I was learning piano at the same time, but and the colors, you know, the reds of the volcanic action against the dinosaurs and the big fight scene and all that. Everything I just found so intriguing and exciting in the scene, the beats of the music to the movements and everything. I loved it. I really enjoy this sequence. It's not my top favorite, but it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I do appreciate the syncopation that interacts between what you're seeing on screen with the music. I mean, that's ripe throughout all of Fantasia and Silly Symphonies, but there is a lot of that with Rite of Spring. And, you know, because of the subject matter and in the music, I feel like it's even more impressive in that way. So I need to give it a couple more fair shots. You know, I did watch it before doing this episode, and it didn't get me, but maybe after hearing your argument on it, I can appreciate it a little bit more.
Maybe when Rory's older, it'll be interesting to see if he likes the dinosaurs.
I mean, right now I can get him through a 2-minute Sesame Street video and not much more. So I'm not gonna put him in front of it yet, but I will do that at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're going to end our exploration of Fantasia in this episode with the film's intermission, which is as unusual as the film itself. An intermission was included because it was Walt's intention for Fantasia to be a concert-like experience. Now, for the roadshow version, Deems Taylor announced a 15-minute intermission following the conclusion of The Rite of Spring. So the musicians are seen departing the orchestra stand, and the doors close to reveal a title card. Now, in the proper roadshow of Fantasia, the theater's curtains would close simultaneously with the closing doors on the screen, and the title card would remain projected for 15 minutes, whilst the guests are briefly excused. Following the intermission, the film would be started again. On screen, the stage doors are reopened and Taylor and the orchestra musicians are seen returning. The orchestra then has an impromptu jam session when the conductor is absent. For this segment, Alec Templeton's piece, Bach Goes to Town, was used. It had been made famous by Benny Goodman in 1938. As the session dies down, Deems Taylor presents the unseen star of Fantasia, the soundtrack. The Disney artists, who were fascinated by old visual patterns, were captivated by the look of the soundtrack. Now, not the musical score, but the narrow band on the left side of the film where the emulsion faces the viewer. This band contains the recorded patterns that are activated when the film is projected to recreate the dialogue, narration, music, and sound effects. Every sound has its own pattern, and Walt decided to create animation based on these patterns. He gave the soundtrack a shy personality, and with the coaxing of the narrator, demonstrated how it makes sounds. So again, this is another abstract sequence.
Yep. But I'm okay with this one because I feel like it works for me. It's a lot more simpler and I feel the story in it, so I'm okay with it. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm always okay with an intermission. I mean, we don't need to get on modern day movies and whether or not they should need an intermission, but the answer is yes.
1000%. I agree with you. Boy, we were talking beforehand about Dune 2. And I was telling friends that when I saw it, I said, you know, when I was a kid, long movies like that, like I just saw a revival of My Fair Lady. There was an intermission in that film. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it was based on a Broadway show and they have intermissions. But long films back in the day had intermissions and they need to bring those back.
Yeah, I think anything, once you get over the 2 hour and 30 minute mark, add an intermission and figure it out. You know, it can be like a Broadway show where, you know, the first half might be a little bit longer, might be that 90 minutes, and the second half is an hour. That's fine. But after that, after that that 2 hour and 30 mark, it should be mandatory. And yeah. I mean, I'm also on the side of theaters with it too. You know, you might lose out on a screening for some really long ones, but you're going to make more money in popcorn and getting people back to the concession stand.
As they go to the bathroom, they're going to smell that popcorn, or they'll want those jujubes or whatever they're going to eat, Junior Mints. With that crinkly cellophane, it drives me nuts.
That's why when we get our bunch of crunch, I know that's very noisy in the box. We take it, we pour it right into the popcorn right away, and that's how we eat it. So that way we're even less obnoxious.
Yeah, I wish everybody did something like that. So...
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, this is cute. It doesn't bother me. I like the part before it. I like the jam session.
Yeah, the jam session's good.
Part I really and like.
I love the musicians leaving and coming back in. Like, that's just one of those nice little touches. They didn't have to do that, but that's what you would see. So I love the authenticity of it. I really no problems with it, but it's an intermission. Yeah, it is what it is.
Now, next time we'll continue our story about Fantasia, starting with the Pastoral Symphony selection, which at the time became the most controversial sequence in the film. And now it's time for This Week in Disney History. All right. Oh, gosh. You know, it's like every other week I forget who starts out.
It's you this week.
That's okay. I was thinking that. All right. Well, I'm starting out with something hugely significant in the history of Disneyland. March 18th, 1967, the Pirates of the Caribbean attraction, this officially opens in New Orleans Square at Disneyland, California. So this is not when New Orleans Square opened, but when the attraction opened. So the debut kicks off with great excitement. And this has been on DVDs and it's on YouTube. They have a group of marauding pirates. Storm, they come off the Columbia and storm New Orleans Square and Pirates of the Caribbean. They're led by Wally Bogue, of course, from the Golden Horseshoe Review. And they Shanghai the sailing ship Columbia, and then, like I said, they come through, they burst through the attraction's doors with a battering ram. And then I thought, what a glorious opening for an attraction. I mean, probably one of the best ever grand openings.
Oh, yeah.
And then of course, and for many people, this is considered the greatest attraction ever made. So, all the figures in the attraction are designed by Imagineer Mark Davis. Everything is so lavish and detailed in this attraction. And all those sets were designed by artist and color stylist Claude Coates. It is the largest audio animatronic project to date. And the last attraction Walt Disney himself worked on extensively before his passing. Simultaneously, the Blue Bayou restaurant opened up in New Orleans Square. And of course, this is in the same show building that houses Pirates of the Caribbean. In fact, as you sit there on the bayou, you see you can see the ships go by, the little bateaus go by, so that you're part of the action. You're actually part of the attraction. Yeah. Which is neat. And then the plantation house up there is sort of a recreation of the chicken restaurant that had sat over near where the Haunted Mansion is now occupying. So they sort of recreated its facade there. And in the early days, they actually had like a jazz band performing up on the balcony there for the restaurant guests and all that. And I have a funny story. When I turned 30, Carol and I went there for my 30th birthday and we ate there. And she had arranged for a cake to be made in the days when they didn't like make cakes for you. So I have no clue how she did it. And they had little Disney characters on it and all that. What I didn't know is she invited a whole bunch of our friends. And they all just sort of showed up there. And so as everybody, we were sitting right at the water, and as we sang, everybody started singing Happy Birthday at the table. Then the restaurant started singing. And then what was cool is everybody going by in the bateau started singing.
I was hoping you were going to say that.
Yeah. And it was just so neat. I mean, that was like, for me, a really magical experience.
Yeah. That's one you'll never, ever forget. I mean, that's pretty up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how she pulled all that off, I have no idea. But that's sort of why the Blue Bayou has always been, you know, special place for me. So
you're a very lucky person, Michael. Mm-hmm. And I still want to eat there one day. I'll get there eventually. So the last couple of times it's been closed every time I've tried to eat there. So I'm being just very unlucky nonstop with it. But Pirates of the Caribbean is great. I knew you were going to choose this one. I truly believe of all of the original stories that Walt Disney, Imagineering, and the parks have created, I think it is the best original attraction that they've done. Might not be the best overall attraction. There might be some better IP ones out there. I know you want to strangle me for that. But, you know, I think it's, as original stories go, it is 1,000% their best one. Yeah. And the Horizon fans and Figment fans, you can go away too. I don't need to hear your arguments for those.
Well, and you know, I think Indiana Jones, at least the original version of it, when it had all the effects working.
Yeah.
It was a good competitor in my book for Pirates of the Caribbean.
I'd say that in terms of IP, I would say that. And then I can make a strong argument for Rise of the Resistance as well. When it's all working correctly, it's all as it's supposed to.
Disneyland, it hasn't been for a while now.
Yeah, Walt Disney World has been even worse. Oh, but what a great attraction.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But for mine, I actually think I did this last year, but I think it's worthy of a check-in again this year. Back in 2019 on this day, that's when Disney officially bought 21st Century Fox, and that went through. And, you know, for the longest time, we've criticized it up and down. I really need to go back at this point last year and see what I said, because I'm pretty sure I talked about this. But the reason I wanted to bring it up today is because, you know, there is no doubt that the Academy Awards, the Oscars, are it's the most prestigious thing in Hollywood. And it honestly, even if people act like it doesn't mean anything, mean a lot, it means a lot to these studios that they can tout when their movies win Academy Awards. And I mean, in 2024, we'd be sitting here without this acquisition saying, hey, guess what? Disney only won nothing because they didn't win anything. Disney itself didn't win anything. Fox Searchlight, part of Fox when they bought it, they won all five Academy Awards that Disney got this year. So without Fox Searchlight, Disney would have came up with nothing. So maybe they would have had a lot more money to spend on other projects, not put themselves in such a bad financial position. But at least from a movie studio, in terms of awards, accolades, I think acquiring Fox Searchlight when they did on March 20th of 2019, I think that was such a good decision for them as a way to expand what they were doing in the world of movies and television. Maybe it wasn't the greatest decision for theme parks and beyond, but it's winning them awards. So it's doing that at least.
I feel that I was excited when they purchased it because I thought 20th Century Fox has such a rich film library. Huge, extensive. And I thought, we're going to start seeing that on Disney Plus. And we're not. We've seen a few musicals. And I thought, why are they not doing that? It's so underutilized. And I would think, they say they're bleeding subscribers right now. And And I don't know if that's true or not, but if you think if they started putting the 20th Century Fox film library on Disney Plus or on Hulu, which is now on Disney Plus or something, you would start attracting more people. I would start watching it a whole lot more. And like another film reviewer that I listened to on YouTube, he like brought up a good example. I guess there's another Planet of the Apes film coming out, which I guess is Fox. He said, why on Disney Plus don't they have like a little, you know, tile card that says, you know, go ape. And it has a link to all the Planet of the Apes films that yeah. Fox made. You know, why are they not doing all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. And they're super excited about this new Planet of the Apes movie. And I think Bob Iger just said recently that, you know, they think it's going to be a big summer tentpole, one of the best Planet of the Apes movies that Fox has made. So if you care that much, why isn't it everywhere right now? You know, save the money on the marketing for the movie, make people go back and rewatch the series mm-hmm. on Disney Plus right now. So that way they are wanting to go see it in the theaters, you know, when it gets closer and they start seeing those TV spots. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, no, I just watched all of those. I can't wait to go see it. Like I'm no expert in this, but it seems like a very easy way to get people more invested in the movies. But there's not enough for Fox on Disney Plus. And that's, you know, I do acknowledge that there are a lot of family friendly Fox titles that they could easily put absolutely. On. More would live on Hulu, I think, in my personal opinion. But if they can get that, you know, kind of the transition to Hulu to be a little bit more seamless. It's pretty well done on Disney Plus. I've actually been watching a lot of my Hulu stuff through Disney Plus now because it saves me the extra time of logging out, logging in. The only difference is like stuff that I watch, like sports. I still watch that through Hulu. That's the cleanest way for me to see that. But for TV shows and movies, I've pretty much stuck with watching through Disney Plus now mm-hmm. through the Hulu section on there. So it's getting close, but I don't know. Maybe it's just they need to get away from the Hulu name there and be like, make a Fox tab that then, you know, automatically knows like, okay, this is on, you know, Fox on Disney, Fox on Hulu, combine it together in that way. Maybe that's how they should go about it.
Yeah. But
I feel like it should have its own section, not just like, hey, we also have Hulu selections and maybe some will be on there. You know, every other studio they own gets a big placement on top of Disney Plus. So why wouldn't Fox get that too?
Yeah, I agree with you. They need to do more. They need to do more with that and with that film library.
Yeah.
So you know, so hopefully they will. Hopefully somebody will wise up over there. But I do want to watch all those. Like when I was a boy, I loved the original Planet of the Apes series.
Yeah.
I thought it was cool. Some of them were terrible, but I still enjoyed them. I've not watched any of the modern ones, and I heard they're really good. So
I watched the first one, mm-hmm. and I don't know. It might have just been, you know, James Franco's the lead in that, and I'm very hot or cold on him. So I didn't really like the first one, so I gave up on the series. And all I've been told from people is like, well, no, if you watch the first one, then they're amazing after that. But
That's what I've heard. Yeah.
I already do that with Star Wars. I have to ignore the Phantom Menace and get through all of that. I don't want to do that with another movie series.
Well, speaking of movie series, I know you like Lego. Are you getting the, or maybe you already got it, the Snow White Lego set?
Oh, yeah, I already bought that. I haven't put it together yet, but that was, I went to the Lego store the morning that came out and picked it up. I didn't do the pre-order with it. I'm like, I need to have it in my hands the day that it's released. And then I've been too busy to put it together.
I haven't gotten it yet. That's one of my retirement things. I have all these Lego sets, and I thought that'd be one thing that I'll do. So,
I'm excited
that I'm going to do Lego. It looks cute. Looks like they did a really good job with it.
Yeah. I hope, you know, I obviously like a lot of people love Cinderella Castle and the train station and some of the smaller ones they made, like the Haunted Mansion one. But I really hope that the Snow White set works out and they start going down the road of more, you know, more sets that kind of depict these iconic buildings and stuff from the actual movies, because I think there's probably a good amount that they could continue with it. I think mm-hmm. Snow White was the brilliant place to start with it, but I would love to see even more. Like sitting behind me in our studio, I have like a Star Wars diorama, and after our episode today, I'm like, how cool would it be to have like a diorama set with for Fantasia with Sorcerer Mickey on top of the mountain?
Oh, that would be
like
cool.
Oh, that would be cool. There's yeah. Oh, I could talk about this for
well they
days.
Could have one of almost every sequence in yeah. it, the dancing hippos and the the dinosaur and Stegosaurus fight. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff they could do. So but wouldn't Geppetto's cottage be a really cool one with all the toys and yep. clocks when you turn it around? And Geppetto and Jiminy Cricket and Figaro and Pinocchio and all that. But that would be cool.
Yeah, I would really love to see one like that too. I think there's a lot more they could do. I'm so happy that Disney and Lego they've gone so hand in hand for the mm-hmm. for years now. I mean, I know a lot of their sets too are also more aimed at younger kids and such, but some of the ones they've been doing for adults lately have just been so incredible.
I heard a report, I think it was last week on our local radio station, more adults now build Legos than children.
I wouldn't dismiss that at all. You know, I think that's actually pretty accurate. When I go to the store at Disney Springs, there's a lot of kids in there, mm-hmm. but there's just as many adults buying the more difficult sets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, it's just one of those activities where I have merged it into my other hobbies that I like doing. You know, it's when I need to release myself more creatively, I usually pick up my guitar. If I want to challenge myself, I'll pick up a puzzle and I'll choose one that I haven't done before and go that route. Or read, you know, or do online puzzles, crosswords, things like that. But every now and then, if I just need something that's like repetitive, but also just straightforward, I'll just do a Lego set, because I mean, for people who haven't done one before, it's not just like, here's all the pieces, figure it out and put it together. It's literally books, giant guidebooks yes. that tell you each process step by step, as easy as it could possibly be. So there's really no guesswork in there. If you don't pay attention and you skip a step, then you have leftover pieces at the end. That is easy to do, and I've done it a couple times. I did it on the last set I built.
I have to take apart my Steamboat Willie one that my granddaughter and I are doing, because I can't get the stacks aren't working, so he did something wrong.
Yeah.
But what I like is that the books are okay, but then they have links to a website where it's the instructions are there, but you can manipulate the pictures.
Yeah.
So if you can't figure out, okay, what piece is it, you can sort of turn it around and then you see, oh, that's what the piece looks like. That is so helpful for me.
Yeah. They have their Lego Builder app that does mm-hmm. the same thing. And what I like about that is that for some reason, when you look at it on a phone or an iPad and you have that brightness all the way up, I feel like you see the true color of the piece yes. that you're looking for. Where sometimes if I'm doing it in a dimmer room, I'll end up being like, I'll use the complete wrong color piece a bunch of times and be like, oh, I didn't see it. There is nothing more frustrating than that when you flip them backwards because you can't see the book well. So it's they make it so easy to fall down a wormhole, and they're not cheap, you know, but I also look at it as they have to pay for the licenses to use the characters and movies and shows that they base these sets off of. So that's part of it. The people who are designing them and originally to mass produce them, I mean, they're doing great things, and there's a lot of pieces that get involved in these sets sometimes, which, you know, I feel like when you throw it all together, you can really justify the price. But the thing about it too is if you are one of those people that you're like, I want to save the box, I want to save every little piece, Lego holds its value completely. And if you have sets that you've never opened that you want to get rid of, you can almost always, depending on how long it's not been out anymore, if you're talking like 5 years it hasn't been for sale, you can easily double your price on it, sometimes triple your price if it's a rare set. If it's, you know, a year old, you can usually get $40-$50 more than what you paid for it. It's really worth it. And for like an open box set, as long as you still have the box and the book and it's in good condition and you have all the pieces, you'll get someone to pay for it for exactly what you paid for. I mean, it's actually an investment for a lot of people. It holds its value, and there's not a lot of toys that do that unless you keep it in the box in pristine condition and you know those toys will never go out of, you know, style or fashion. So all the people that thought that would be that way with Funko Pops, you know, they're kicking themselves.
So, okay, I have the Disney set that everyone would like if they ever did Toad Hall.
Oh, that would be so good.
Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be great. So we've talked about it before with attractions. I would love to see attraction exteriors in general, like have Toad Hall next to the Peter Pan queue. Have a whole little Fantasyland set. I love when I see, there's one creator that I see all the time on Instagram that builds little small replicas of the theme parks out of Lego sets, and it blows me away every time. And one went viral a year ago, maybe even less than that, where it was a full ride through of Pirates of the Caribbean
built as Lego. Gosh.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find it and send it to you. It's incredible. I mean, for it being Lego,
you could get people to pay to see it. He had it on display.
I know. That's at least you're the most popular person in the neighborhood.
Well, you know, our friend David Younger, we had on the show years ago, who is a Disney Imagineer. He for years designed Lego sets of Christmas villages, things like that, and then he would sell the. He would then determine, okay, what the bricks are needed and all that, and then he would sell the plans. And he would sell books of plans. And he did this in England. And he made, he was quite popular. Now he's designing a game. Now he's into games and all that online games and stuff. But I bet somebody could design, you know, if they designed a theme park attraction facade, they could probably sell the plans and people would buy. To buy them, and then they tell you exactly what bricks you need, the sizes, the colors, and all that stuff. So you could go into a Lego store or something and buy the bricks you need. Can you still buy individual bricks?
So I know that you can do that through like third party companies where you can, you know, people that will go out and buy like the big giant bins, or they'll buy sets and literally just keep them so they can keep the individual pieces and resell them. So if you can't find big boxes at, you know, Walmart, Target, at Lego stores, and that way you always have the third party companies that will hold them too. And it's not really a bad deal, honestly. There's been a couple times where I've had to look to those sites for like when I screw up putting a sticker on some of the Lego sets I have, because I'm very anal about the stickers. If I don't get them perfectly in the center, then I lose it. I can't look at it anymore. Or I already talked about screwing up colors. There was one time I put the wrong sticker on the wrong color piece, and just like it still drives me nuts to this day.
It would,
years later. So I've used them before. They're very trustworthy. It's such a fun little hobby. So if we haven't convinced you yet, I don't think we're going to be able to, but give it a shot.
I agree. So anyway, and so that's good. So yeah, I'll have to get that Snow White set. Do it. Add it to my closet of Lego kits that I'm going to build someday. Anyway, well, I used several references in working on this episode, some books I used, including Walt Disney's Fantasia by John Culhane, Walt Disney Film Archives, the animated movies, 1921 to 1968. That's that big Toshin book. Walt Disney's Fantasia by Deems Taylor, and the original Fantasia film program. Some websites and articles I looked at: the Making of Fantasia, Disney's Masterpiece for the Houston Symphony, the Disney Wiki entry on Fantasia, Walt Disney's Fantasia by JustDisney.com, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, The Genesis of Fantasia by Jay Gabler for Your Classical, 15 Fascinating Facts About Fantasia, D23.com, Fantasia, Walt Disney's Pioneering Classic by Jamie Atkins, and Bringing Evolution to the Masses, Disney's Fantasia as History of Biology by Charles Pence. So Craig will include links to these resources in our episode description. So Craig, until next time, how can our listeners connect with you?
As always, you can find me on the different shows I'm on, the Diz Unlimited podcast network. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Teleclaster. And you can find me via email, craig@disneyinfo.com. What about you, Michael?
You can send me messages at michaelbowling@disneyinfo.com. On Twitter, I'm at mbowling121. Facebook, Michael Bowling - Connecting with Walt, and Instagram, Michael Bowling the Diz. You can connect with me and Craig on Twitter at Connecting Walt. If you'd like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studios, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes on the link Craig includes in our episode description. And look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, Pandora, and Amazon Podcasts, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings when possible. So thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother, Roy.